Hello.
Messing with the levels here. You just keep talking.
Okay. La 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 la.
La 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 la. I just want to make sure that both the levels are kind of like equal, because I usually have to turn your one a little bit louder, and you have a lower voice than mine. But now my one looks very low. All right. I think that's good enough. All right. Okay. Hey, you, and welcome.
It'll do.
Yeah, exactly. Fuck this shit. All right. Hey, you, and welcome. My name is Mike, and with me is Keith, co-host of the That Chapter podcast, and welcome back to another episode.
Hey-o.
There we go. Good old Keith. I'm always really fucking bad at this part of the podcast. We're trying to introduce.
Intros are hard.
They're very hard.
I can tell today that when I came in that you've been excited to talk to someone, anyone.
Yes, I've been home alone for quite a while now.
Waiting at the door when I get
in.
Hi,
exactly,
how are you?
I'm just running away. Keith's coming, Keith's coming. Because I've been home alone for like the last week and a half, and it's been horrible. I have not talked to any single person, used my voice, other than literally recording videos. It's the only fucking thing I've done. For talking is recording videos, so it's nice to actually be able to talk with somebody. I think that's why I'm finding it weird to talk to you right now.
Right.
Even moving my mat this way, it's like
tiring.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm home alone because me and the wife, we were in Budapest for our 1 year anniversary.
Nice.
And she's seen a ghost. She's seen a mother flipping ghost.
Tell
you
me
believe
more.
That? Oh, okay. So Budapest, by the way, rules. It's a great city. So
I didn't realize that Buda and Pest are two different.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Buda and then you have the river and then you have Pest.
Exactly. They're two separate cities, or they were two separate cities now. Mm. They just combined them. But yeah, there's Buda is on one side, then it's the Danube, and then it's Pest.
Mm.
Or Pest, as they say. But Budapest is a great city. It rules. It's pretty one of my favorite cities in Europe.
Yeah, it's cool. The architecture, like I'm not really into architecture. I wouldn't really go around and go, oh, look at that building. That's lovely. But when I was in Budapest, the architecture is amazing.
Like, it is,
it's that good that I notice it. I think it's because it's been taken over by so many different civilizations or different groups of people, cultures.
Yeah,
that like you walk down one street and it's real like Art Deco, and you walk down another street, it's like more medieval. It's cool.
Yeah, it's a really, really beautiful city. It feels like when you're there, it's like really old Europe kind of vibe to it, which is cool. It feels like you're kind of going back in time, like to the old like pre-World War One Europe, like the very fancy Europe.
It's very classy.
Yeah, the classy Europe. Yeah, exactly. Like Mozart Europe.
Yes.
Which is cool. So anyway, the story, I'm just so glad as I can tell a ghost story.
Okay,
you're always the one with the ghost stories. Now I finally got one. Anyway, by the way, so it's my wife who seen this ghost, not me. So it was the last night. We were there for 3 nights. It was a very nice hotel.
Okay.
And she went to bed, and my brother came over for one night to join us, because he lives not that far away, like in a different country, but in Europe. But he just came over for one night while we were there. So me and him were at the bar drinking, and then I left to go back up to the room, and this is about midnight. And I think I was like pretty locked at this point. Anyway, I just collapsed into bed. And then she says that she woke up at like about 1:30 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And she's seen me standing there at the end of the bed. So like I'm on like, say if you're lying down in bed, I'm on the left.
Yeah.
She would sleep on the right. And the figure was to the right, like bottom right.
Okay.
So she's there and she was
so
like.
So the figure was on her side.
It was on her
bottom.
Side.
Okay.
Yeah. And her side was closer to the door.
Okay. Right.
And so she's like, oh, Mike, what are you doing? Figure it was like just she said she couldn't make it out. It was just like completely black.
Yeah,
and then she kind of
clearly
up.
A person.
Yeah, she said it was kind of like moving, like swaying, kind of slightly.
Oh, okay,
and then she's like, "What are you doing?" Like she thought I'd just gotten up in the middle of the night to go like use the bathroom or something. And then she was saying, but figure wasn't answering. So she reached over and then she touched, and I was in the bed.
No!
I was asleep. And then she said
chills,
she saw
man.
The figure start walking towards the door.
Yeah,
and then she looked over at me and she looked back and it was gone.
Oh fuck!
It's really weird. It's really creepy. I thought she told me first thing. I was like, "That is fucking cool."
Yeah.
So then the next morning we were checking out of the hotel. Yes, content. This is gonna be such a good story. Then the next morning we were checking out of the hotel.
Yeah.
And when we were checking out, I went to the lady who was behind the reception or whatever, and I was like, "Here, listen, babe." I said, "I got a strange question for you.
Yeah.
Has any other guests ever reported seeing anything weird or creepy or ghosts?" Is what I said, and then she was like, "Well, actually, some people have said they've seen weird things." Now, so the hotel, it's like, it's really fancy. It's kind of like in downtown Budapest. It's right beside the Danube.
Yeah.
It's like an old palace. Like the building is well over 100 years old.
Yeah,
it's really tall and fancy. And
it's not the Intercontinental, is it?
No. It's not far from it, but it's not that.
Okay,
it's not on that strip, but it's like not far from.
Right.
But anyways, yeah, she says, yeah, people have seen, reported seeing weird things and ghosts. And she said they had a ghost hunter or some shit in one time who said it's the ghost of a princess.
Right, okay.
Who haunts the hotel still.
Ooh.
I thought that was pretty cool.
That is awesome.
Although then it means that my wife saw a figure standing, thought it was me when it's actually a ghost of a woman. So I don't know what that is.
Your lovely womanly figure.
Yeah, exactly. My shapely figure. She said she thought it was me. It was like my stature or whatever, but it was completely black. And it was like, but it, she said it was like definitely moving. Yeah. Like obviously you can just say it's, the weird thing I'd always say is like, okay, you could say she was half asleep. She was dreaming or hallucinating or something. And there was nothing, like there's nothing in that room you could confuse it for. So it wasn't like a coat or something.
Yeah.
But whenever that argument comes up, I always think, well, heck, you know, heck, it's never happened before or since.
Yeah.
You know, I always have a weird feeling about it. But I thought that was awesome.
That is awesome.
I love it. So, yeah. So that's my little story, I guess. There you go.
Your wife's seen a ghost. That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. What else is going on? Oh, it's a Super Bowl week for, well, here. So for those listeners, by the time you folks at home are listening to this, the Super Bowl will be over. It's the Chiefs and the Niners. Mm-hmm. Spoiler. Don't tell us. Don't tell me who wins. No spoilers. In this scenario, they can speak from the future and we can also hear them.
Got it. Well, we know ghosts are real. So.
Yeah, hey, anything's possible. The listener just calls up, hello. But we can be there.
Yeah, this is the first call, and I mean ever. Yeah. This is not a phone-in show.
Yeah. So the Super Bowl is on. Leave in the comments who won. I hope they both lose. Yeah, that's my opinion. They both suck.
Right.
I suppose if I had to pick one, I'd pick 49ers.
You love to be watching it, yeah?
Yeah, I will. So it starts at 11:30 here, because it's at 5 hours.
Okay, yeah.
So I hope it's... Yeah, it should kick off at 11:30. So that's going to be a fun night.
Nice.
See if I can survive long enough.
Are you going to stay in and watch it, or are you going to go out?
No, I'll probably go out somewhere that's showing it. See who's around. I'm sure it's gonna be showing it somewhere, but as I said, it's so fucking late, it's hard to find a place to watch it.
So
what else has been going on? That's my stories. Ghosts in Budapest. What else have been doing? Nothing, just trying not to go insane by being here the whole time by myself. And what else? What do you got going on, Keith?
Me, it's been a quiet week. I'm just about feeling better. I went out on Saturday, it's Wednesday now, and I went out on Saturday night, and I'm just about starting to feel better.
I love that feeling.
Oh my God.
You get all age, the hangovers just get worse and worse.
Oh my God,
worse.
Man, they're getting so much worse. Yeah. I haven't actually been out in a while, and went out with a bunch of college friends.
Yeah.
And it was a heavy night. Whew, definitely feeling it. So I'm just about over that now. So I've just kind of been nursing myself for the last couple of weeks, for the last couple of days.
As I've said in previous episodes, I was doing the dry January, which I failed.
Oh, yeah.
It was about 2 weeks ago.
You're doing moist January.
Yeah, I did. I did damp January. A couple of, it was like 2 weeks ago, we had a friend up for a couple of drinks in here, in my apartment. And like nothing crazy, wasn't a late one. They left probably like before midnight. I was drinking beer and I was mixing it with whiskey. I had like three whiskeys.
And
a couple of beers. Like, I went to bed, you know, I didn't feel drunk, anything. Like, I could tell I'd been drinking, but I wasn't, like, swaying. I never get that drunk anymore.
Yeah, no,
I wasn't swaying.
Yeah.
But then the next morning...
The spinnies in bed.
I was bad. I didn't have a spinnies in bed, but the next morning I puked three times the next morning. And I didn't even drink that much. My hangovers, and I was just, on the couch. I was watching, you know, my comfort TV is, like, adventure TV shows. That's what I love watching, like... I watched Les Stroud. You know, he's that Canadian guy who does the surviving. I love survival shows.
Okay, yeah.
So I was watching him just surviving in the fucking Sahara outback or some shows. I know you feel, I'm dying. And like,
survive.
Yeah, exactly. I felt worse than he did. So yeah, that was it. That's my drinking. Yeah, I'm done drinking. I can't do it anymore till I do it again very soon.
I know, yeah. Actually, which will be very soon, actually, because we're going to be going... Well, actually, no. It's the end of the month. We'll be going out.
Right now. For recording. We'll do our video podcast episode. Yeah, we're doing that this month.
Yeah, probably have a couple of drinks
this
after.
This February. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We'll have a few drinks. Yeah, we can crack with some beers. We'll get the videos up and we can... Yeah, it'd be great.
You know,
our listener tales. People are still sending them in. I have gotten... Man, we won't be able to do them all in the first episode. There's simply too many.
Okay, yeah.
There's like... It's amazing. I think we'll have to make this a thing.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe we could do it as like a bonus episode.
Yeah.
As like every second week or something we do put out two podcast episodes, and the second was this listener tales.
Well, let's keep doing it until we capture the ghost in my attic on camera.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That sounds good. Yeah. Okay.
I'll bring ghost. Your wife can bring her ghost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Ghosts galore. And speaking of ghosts, let's get into today's story, which doesn't actually have anything to do with ghosts. But it does begin with a G. And his name is Jared John Schaefer. So yeah, today we're talking about a serial killer, the Butcher of Blind Creek. Me and Keith were talking about some of the stories we've covered before we started recording this episode. Mm. And I think we both were in agreement that the worst we've covered was Bob Burdella, the Kansas City Butcher.
Yeah, that has stuck with me.
Yeah.
I think about it often.
I don't think about it often because I don't fucking want to think about it often. But like of all the stories I've covered on the videos, the That Chapter videos, or on the podcast, that one I think is the worst one I've done. Like the most horrific serial killer, like pure evil, whatever the fuck you wanted, like just horrific story.
It was one of I think it's because like obviously when you listen to it, you listen to it. I think the episode's like an hour or whatever it is.
Yeah,
but like it was research for like a week and a half, and by the end of it, I was like, I'd never want to hear that name again.
Mm.
It's, he was bad. But I think this guy's a close second.
He is. This guy's a real close second. Mm. Yes, he's a real piece of shit. I'm sure a lot of you guys are pretty familiar with him. But if you're not, let's give it a go. And if you are familiar, well then buckle up, buckaroo. Let's get into it.
There was an FBI agent that said, I think he was in the FBI, but he said basically Schaefer made Ted Bundy look like a Boy Scout. So that's where we're at.
Ted Bundy gets so much fucking attention for being a little cocksucker. Like he's a fucking everywhere. There's like a million movies made about this prick.
Yeah.
And it's like, fuck him. I mean, okay, obviously he was an evil bastard who did horrific things, but it's like, this guy? Come on. Like he's obviously a real piece of shit.
Yeah.
But you know what? You just can't beat being an unoriginal bastard. So just keep making the same shit.
That's probably why I didn't, like, before this, Schaefer, I wasn't too familiar with him. Didn't really know his crimes too much. I say there's probably a reason for it. It's a bit heavy for the media, where I think like with Bundy and stuff, it was obviously what the crimes he did were horrific, but these crimes are like just out of the stratosphere. They're so bad. It's hard to make it sound
palatable.
Exactly.
As opposed to like Jeffrey Dahmer boiling. Why is it that everybody just loves Jeffrey Dahmer? People are just obsessed with him.
I don't know.
Especially chicks. Chicks love him.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, boiling people's brains and shit like that.
He's a bad boy.
Dahmer and Schaefer have some similarities, and that prison did not go well for either of them. Yeah. All right, so let's begin. On the morning of July 21st, 1972, a deputy from the Martin County Sheriff's Department, that's eastern Florida, just north of Palm Beach, West Palm Beach, if that gives you any vague reference to where we're talking about, Jared John Schaefer, he was driving along in his patrol car when he spotted two young girls hitchhiking. Naturally, as a police officer, he wanted to see that they got where they were going safely, and so he pulled up. After a little lecture on the perils of hitchhiking and just how many weirdos there are out there looking to take advantage of two young girls, Schaefer offered to take the girls to Stewart, a town in the county that's along the coast. On the way, the girls got chatting to Jared and introduced themselves as 18-year-old Nancy Ellen Trotter from Farmington, Michigan, and Paula Sue Wells, who was 17, from Garland, Texas. The girls told Schaefer that they were planning on heading to Jensen Beach, which was about 8 miles north of Stewart, the very next day. Upon hearing this, Schaefer told them that it would be much safer if he came and picked them up. And that's exactly what happened, meeting him the next day just after 9 a.m. At first, the girls were a bit unsure of Schaefer when he arrived out of uniform and driving his own unmarked car. Schaefer, now, he assured the teenagers, though, that he was still, in fact, on duty and had, just switched to plain clothes work that day. The two girls, Trotter and Wells, shrugged off any suspicions, and the three of them set off to Jensen Beach, which I mean, come on! You know, that's not where they were going.
This is not going to be a fun day to seaside.
No.
But the 70s, they were like the golden years for serial killers luring victims into cars. Ted Bundy, who we mentioned, John Wayne Gacy, the Candyman, Randy Kraft. So I don't think there's a huge amount of warnings out there about getting in cars with strangers.
Yeah. Especially, I think police were probably just viewed a lot more. I mean, obviously, police are still powerful today, but I guess they were just a lot more like, don't argue, like, do whatever a cop tells you. Whereas now people are suspicious, probably because of shit like this.
Yeah, yeah. And he was sneaky as well, because so the first time when you gave him a lift in the police car and he was in uniform, he called it into the station.
Jared Schaefer.
Yeah, so he called up the station, like, hey, I've picked up these two girls, I'm just going to drop them home just to let you know. And they're like, great. So I guess when you hear that, it's like, oh no, he's legit. It's not just, he's not going rogue. He's called it in, that's fine. So, but obviously the next day when he came in unmarked car and not in uniform, that was a bit strange.
Do you ever think about like why there are so many, or I was reading about it, why there were so many serial killers in like the 70s and the 80s, and they put it back to childhood trauma and shit like that a lot of the time?
Hmm.
They were the children of soldiers and people who had fought during World War II.
Oh.
They would have been like, they would have been in their 30s probably.
Yeah.
If they were born shortly after World War II. And it's like, that's, it's like something about like generational trauma creates serial killers. So every time there's a big event, like a war,
yeah.
the children of that, or who were children at the time, a lot of times that's why there's kind of like a peak in serial killers. Yeah. That's why there's somebody theorizing that in like, well, I guess fucking 20 years now, that there might be another rake of serial killers of like people who were children during like the Great Recession and shit like that.
Okay, yeah.
But like when they're grown up, they'll be serial killers. Like, you know, there will be a spike in, in killers and shit like that. Although then again, there's always kind of been a spike in serial killers. I think it's probably just more reported on. And maybe technology just caught up. I actually disagree with what I just said. I just talked myself out of my own fucking point. Moving on.
A one-man debate.
Yeah, I know. Fuck you, Mike. You're right, Mike. No sooner had the journey started that Schaefer started telling the girls all about an old Spanish fort somewhere near Hutchinson Island.
Have you seen the picture of the fort?
No. Did you just interrupt me?
I'm sorry, but it's very important.
Okay. Sure. Show me a picture, Keith.
Oh, I haven't got a picture. I was just going to explain it, but it's not
Well, I mean, we can't show it to the audience. It's not a visual thing, so yes, you better off just explaining it.
Well, it's not that important. It's not a fort. He just basically brought him out to like this beat up old wooden cabin in the middle of the woods. So I'm sure like when you seen it, like, oh shit.
Hutchinson Island. Mm. I love how we're just interrupting the entire flow of the story just to tell.
We can cut this out.
Nope.
Okay, so there is actual, it looks like there is some sort of fort. It's not that. Basically, I seen a photo of where he brought them and it's just a wooden cabin.
Oh yeah, I think I've seen that. Yeah.
So that's where he brought them to. Yeah. It was a Spanish fort. Yeah. It was not.
So on the way, Schaefer launched into a diatribe about the risks of accepting lifts from strangers and ranted about people just like them being sold into what he described as, quote, white slavery. Ding, 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 crazy bell alarm going off here. No doubt the girls were panicking due to this weird diatribes and the rants he was going on. And this was long before Schaefer pulled up next to a tatty old shed somewhere deep inside the dense woodland. I'm sure when they arrived, their hearts would have been beating out of their chests, and things went south very quickly when Schaefer then handcuffed and gagged Trotter and Wells.
I say that moment when, like before they got handcuffed and gagged, I say that moment when he just started to sense something was going wrong. It was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
And I kind of looking at you, I was like, what's going on?
It's weird.
This guy's weird when you get out of here.
Yeah. And then he's like, well, he was, you know, and he comes up with the fucking handcuffs. Schaefer then separated the girls and tied Trotter's legs to a cypress tree beside the Indian River. He had her stood on the exposed roots of the tree deliberately. By having her stand on the roots and putting a noose around her neck, had she then even made the slightest movement, she simply would have hanged herself. Essentially, it was like an ultra crude jigsaw trap. It's like in, you know, The Good, Bad, the Ugly. At the very end of the movie, when Tuco is standing on top of the grave or whatever. Mm. Essentially, it's that if she moved, she would fall off and die. With Trotter in place, he returned to retrieve Wells, who he took to another tree not far from Trotter and tied her up in the same way, complete with the noose. While he was tying the girl's legs, he told them that he planned to rape and murder them.
This really kind of shows the type of person that Schaefer was. Like, sharing his plans was, it was a way to assert power and control over the girls. He really enjoyed the fear and panic that it caused.
Yeah.
Even the way in which he separated the girls so they couldn't see each other, but they could still hear each other. It just adds a whole new level of fear to the whole situation.
Yeah.
And there was also like an element of this like fantasy fulfillment here. Again, like sharing details was a way to indulge more in his sadistic fantasies further. Yeah. But messed up.
Big into the psychological torture. Schaefer, for sure. Now, fortunately for the girls, a twist of fate fell in their favor, as at that moment, Schaefer just so happened to receive an urgent call from the sheriff's office and was told he needed to get his ass back to the police station right away. He told the girls he had to leave, but warned them against trying to escape, making it clear that if they made a wrong move, if they moved off those roots they were standing on, they would be hanged. He also told them he would only be a short distance down the road, and should they manage to escape, he would capture them again soon anyway. Basically, he said everything he could to try and make them feel helpless so they wouldn't move a muscle. In all, he was gone around 2 hours or so before he returned, looking to make good on his promise. But Schaefer had completely underestimated the resolve of the two teenage girls and discovered nothing but a couple of empty nooses hanging from the trees. Far from the man of the bush and expert tracker he had made himself out to be when talking to the girls to scare them, Schaefer immediately crumbled and he returned home. Shit out of luck and brain cells, he called the sheriff from his home and told him. I can't believe he said this. Talking to his boss, the sheriff, I've done something very foolish. You'll be mad at me. You're going to be so mad at me. Oh, man. Just me and my big mouth. Yeah, it's like so fucking stupid. So,
okay, and I promise you're not going to get mad.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm really going to need you to promise you don't get mad at me.
It was pretty good. So what Schaefer told the sheriff was a very believable story, is that he had tried to teach the girls a lesson about the dangers of hitchhiking, and he might have, quote, overdone the job. Yeah, he did. He did for sure. He told his, no doubt, absolutely raging boss that he had abandoned the two girls somewhere in the swampland around Hutchinson Island near the Indian River. Sheriff Robert Crowder and his lieutenant raced right to the scene, unsure of what, if anything, they would find. On their way, they heard over the radio that a young girl had been found by a truck driver in a serious state of distress, and she was now sitting in the police station. That was Paula Wells. Nancy Trotter was still out there somewhere, and, as it just so happened, as the officers were close to their destination on a Florida state road, they spotted an obviously terrified young girl in the Indian River beside, with her hands still tied around her back, somehow managing to keep herself afloat and propelling herself along the frigid water just by kicking her feet. That was Nancy Trotter. I wonder why the two girls didn't escape together. Like, why did they separate when they escaped?
I don't know.
The officers watched as she fought her way out of the river and onto the bank where, with her clothes obviously tattered and torn, she started to signal them. Usually, the sight of the police in a moment of distress would be the relief of all reliefs, but considering who it was who'd put her in this situation, I'm sure Nancy had, maybe just a couple of second thoughts about the police here. Maybe this is all the police are rapists and murderers down here. It is Florida. But ultimately, she had little choice but to trust them. And luckily for her, they were the good guys. Nancy told them that her friend was out there somewhere in the forest, and Sheriff Crowder told her that Paula was already safe and back at the police station. I'm sure that right up until the moment they arrived, Nancy would still have had a nagging doubt about whether or not the police are really there to actually help her.
Yeah, that would be really difficult to trust them. I say the river was so scary as well, not only because, you know, her hands were tied behind her back and fear of drowning, but it is Florida, and there's still a shit ton in that river that can kill you. Mm-hmm. Nancy actually, she did say later that she was stung twice by jellyfish while she was in the river. Yeah.
Wow. And then there's alligators and shit.
Snapping turtles.
Yeah.
Biting at your toes.
Yeah. Although then again, it's like the other option is be raped and murdered. So
yeah, I think I'll take my chance with a
snapping turtle. Yeah, I'll probably take my chances. It's a thinker, but you know. So back at the station, Nancy reiterated the course of events up to where she was found by the sheriff, but if you can believe it, it was just slightly different from the story Schaefer was telling. Shockingly, I know. The girls had managed to escape, only by very carefully and slowly spending the couple of hours Schaefer had left them alone, working their way out of their restraints, nooses, and gags. They had been unable to free themselves completely, but it was enough to be able to use a lot of bravery and determination to get as far from where they'd been left as possible. It wasn't difficult for the girls to formally ID Schaefer and his car. He was literally a cop working in the very station they'd been taken to after their escape. But Schaefer, come on, liars! His story was very different. He swore to Crowder that he had simply been misguided and overzealous in his efforts to try and correct the girls' wayward lives. Crowder wasn't buying it for a second, though, and he had Schaefer immediately dismissed and placed in cuffs. Facing charges of false imprisonment and aggravated assault, Schaefer continued to plead his innocence. And a fair play to Sheriff Crowder. Like, usually, you know, you often hear kind of negative stories about cops ganging up the blue line or whatever. It's like, no, the sheriff was like, no, I believe the girls. Fuck you.
Good for him. I love Schaefer. He's like, what? You told me you wouldn't get mad. That's completely unfair.
Someone who did believe Schaefer's version of events, however, was his wife at the time, and after he was somehow allowed to be released on $15,000 bail, he returned home to her. She'd later say she had believed him right up until his trial, and he'd acted perfectly normally, as though nothing had happened, and seemed to expect the charges to just go away. He just thought everyone would change their minds, and he could talk his way out of any consequences. Jared John Schaefer was only 26 years old at the time. He was still a very young man. I was actually reading through a lot of this. I was surprised how young he was.
Yeah,
he was a young fellow. He even got himself a new job at a quick check store. Just how much of his arrogance was a front and how much he really believed he could get away with it all is unsure, because Schaefer had a long and storied history. The kidnappings had taken place in July 1972, and the trial for those kidnappings was scheduled for December 1972. And given the severity of his crimes, Schaefer should have been safely in custody. The fact that he wasn't, the fact that he was released on bail, would end up having catastrophic results.
It's unbelievable that they let him out.
Yeah, it is. Because, get a load of this, folks, on the afternoon of the 27th of September 1972, this is, what, 3 months after the kidnappings of the two young girls, Lucille Place came home to find her 17-year-old daughter, Susan Carol Place, apparently tidying up her bedroom. Also there in Lucille's home was Susan's best friend, 16-year-old Georgia Marie Jessup, and another 20-something-year-old man Lucille didn't recognize, but the girls introduced him to her as Jerry. Susan told her mother that the three planned on heading down to the beach at Fort Lauderdale to enjoy the sun and play a bit of Gitbox. Naturally, Lucille wasn't too thrilled with the idea, and despite Jerry's assurances that his intentions were honorable, she still was more than a little concerned and made sure to write down the license plate of his 1969 Datsun parked outside. Before leaving, Susan told her mother that though she planned to leave, she would remain in contact and would be back in just a bit, wouldn't be gone for long. Lucille said the girls left with Jerry in his Datsun around 8:15 in the PM.
It's so late to go to the beach.
It is. What this story is like makes no sense. Why would you go to the beach in the middle of the night?
No, yeah.
Yeah. 4 days later, on the 1st of October, 1972, when Lucille hadn't heard anything from Susan, she finally gave in and called George's mother, Shirley. It took her 4 days to give in, which is pretty amazing, this whole story. But hey, it's the 70s, you know, what can you say? Shirley told Susan that she also hadn't seen her daughter for 4 days either, because Georgia had run away on the 27th, the same day the girls introduced Lucille to Jerry and set off for Fort Lauderdale. Lucille called the police right away to report her daughter and Georgia as missing persons. Given the ages of the girls, the case was treated with more urgency than usual, but was by no means, you know, the all-out intensive search it would be today. Lucille passed investigators a detailed description of the man she knew as Jerry, in addition to the license plate number of the car he'd been driving. Unfortunately, Jerry had covered his tracks. He knew exactly what he was doing, and terrifyingly, he knew exactly what he was going to do to those girls when he'd been sitting in Lucille's house. When the police ran the plate number that Lucille was 100% certain was on Jerry's Datsun, it came back to a completely different car, registered to a St. Petersburg, Florida address, and the registered owner of the car was nothing like the description of Jerry the police had been given. Just to be extra certain, the owner of the license plate was even asked for his whereabouts, just in case he'd managed to drastically change his appearance, or maybe Lucille had simply misremembered details, but no. He had a rock-solid alibi. Of course, we know exactly who they were looking for, but with leads drying up, including tracking down the only man in the area named Jerry Shepherd, when Lucille remembered hearing that as his second name, the case ultimately began to cool. The license plate led nowhere, the name led nowhere, and it was very much pushed to the back of the case pile.
Yeah, Schaefer, he did have a slight advantage of knowing what the police would look for, so he was able to stay one step ahead.
Yeah.
For now, anyway. It was similar to the Golden State Killer. He was also a former cop, and he used his training and his knowledge of police procedures and forensics to evade detection for many years. However, this wasn't exactly the case here. It did seem at the time that he might have stolen the license plate, but actually what really happened, which came out later, was Lucille, when she gave the police the license plate number over the phone, they wrote it down wrong. Which is why correct car or person never showed up. So they were
So stupid. Do you think you would double check?
Right?
Can you just give me that license plate just one more time? Yeah. Like in person?
Yeah, yeah. Like they went as far as to go and like follow up on that license plate. They went that far without even
double checking.
Oh,
at least somebody else. Maybe we should just double check that we got it right.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of times in this when the police absolutely bungle it.
Yeah, wow. Mother of God. All right. So who was the man known as Jerry the cops were looking for? Just who was Gerard John Schaefer? Schaefer was born on March 26, 1946, in Neenah, a very small city in Winnebago County, Wisconsin. There's a lot of serial killers and killers from Wisconsin, actually. I guess there really is nothing to do there other than cheese and
kill.
Yeah, that's it. You said it. Schaefer was the eldest of three children born to traveling salesman Gerard John Schaefer Sr. and his homemaker mother Doris Marie Schaefer. You know what, that's another thing. A lot of traveling salesmen have serial killer children. I've noticed. It comes up again and again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, maybe just all traveling salesmen are pieces of shit who beat their kids. Do you ever think of that?
That could be it. That's
could be.
Probably
I think
it.
I nailed it. Ding, ding, ding. No need to dispute this anymore.
I'd say it's a mix between just having like a childhood of just complete inconsistency. Mm. Like you're not stuck to one place. You never get to make proper friends. You're moved from home to home constantly. And then also like from what I've heard from the other stories we've covered, a lot of them are like alcoholics. Mm. And then also like kind of going with the traveling salesman, a lot of them are adulterers as well. So they're always cheating on the wives.
Yeah,
so
baby.
It always seems to have some sort of tension in the marriage because of that. So you're kind of growing up a very tense atmosphere all the time. And then also being moved home to home.
Hey, listen, you know, you can only crank your hog so many times before you need to release that tension somewhere else, and no better way than, you know what I mean? Jared John Schaefer's way. Jared Sr. obviously moved around a lot for work, and his family did their share of moving too as a result. Doris, Jared, and the siblings moved from Neenah to Nashville, Tennessee to Atlanta, Georgia, before settling in Fort Lauderdale, Florida from 1960 onwards. Jerry Sr. was rarely at home, but when he was, as we were kind of just saying, life wasn't too much fun for the old wife and kids. Jerry Sr. had a bit of a problem with the old glug glug strangle strangle. Schaefer, the younger, later spoke about his father being absent only to return and subjecting him and the family to non-stop verbal and physical abuse until it was time to go away again. The abuse also drove Schaefer Jr. to be very close to his mother, who was obviously very protective of her three children.
A lot of what we know about Schaefer's childhood was from his own mouth. And as we'll learn, as we get more into the story, he was a complete liar and contradicted himself a lot. However, his father, he definitely was abusive. We know that much is true. Schaefer's parents, they did get divorced years later when he was a young adult. But on the divorce papers, the reason his mother cited for leaving her husband was extreme cruelty, chronic drunkenness and adultery. So he was a piece of shit.
Ah, well, you know, don't be too harsh on him.
He's doing his best, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's a hardworking man.
Blue collar.
Just do what he can for his wife and kids. The ungrateful wife and those rugrats. Gerald John Schaefer, the younger, was always a bit of a loner, preferring to be outdoors, wandering in the open to being home and around people. It's the one thing that he bonded with his father over. See, it wasn't so bad. As the two would go on hikes and hunts together on the rare occasions his father was home and sober. He even gained himself a bit of a reputation as a woodsman and harbored aspirations of becoming a forest ranger later in life.
He also used to hunt animals, which you couldn't eat, so just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
One of his classmates said that one time he killed a songbird in front of him. So if you're playing serial killer bingo, mark killing off small animals off your list.
That's a big one. That's a big dinger right there. So far, all seems like a difficult childhood and youth, but nothing spectacularly different from all the other people who have really shitty childhoods but don't go on to be serial killers. As we were saying, hunting and great outdoors weren't the only interests that Schaefer developed in his teenage years. Only the other ones weren't the type to be shared with the family, or at least I hope not. As a teenager, you see, when most were struggling with acne and adolescent crushes, Jerry Schaefer was also discovering his sexuality. Only for Jerry, rather than discovering whether he liked boys, girls, or both, Jerry very early on realized what really got his blood pumping was the idea of hurting people and being hurt. That's what got him off.
I need my tools.
Tools.
Tools, duct tape, zip ties, and gloves. I have to have my tools.
Jerry was very curious about sadomasochism, and not the kind where everyone is having a good time. He wanted to be the only one enjoying events. At first, he vented his tensions by experimenting with autoerotic asphyxiation, which was dangerous, but only to himself at least. But as time went on, the fantasies grew more and more intense until he couldn't resist getting other people involved, whether they liked it or, more likely, didn't like it.
Schaefer, he believed that his father loved his sister more than him, which caused like a lot of self-loathing. He was actually quoted saying, "My father favored my sister, so I wanted to be a girl. I wanted to die. I was just a disappointment to my family as a kid." So experimenting with this autoerotic asphyxiation was possibly a way to deal with his emotions through like self-harm. Mm-hmm. However, his own self-loathing seemed to spill over then into hating others. It's like he couldn't deal with his own feelings just by keeping them inward anymore. So mm-hmm. he had to then like project them onto right. others. And then this resentment towards his sister is likely linked to his targets being women or girls. The absolute like just aggression and degradation he showed towards them.
Mm, but, that's yeah. interesting because yeah, usually it's like it's all about the mother, mm. but it's like oh, him wasn't about her, but it was about his sister. Yeah, yeah no, the other woman in his life yeah. from a young age.
Yeah, he liked his mother.
Yeah, good for him. The first escalation into the very much not okay experimenting with his sexuality took the form of peeping, something that's not great, and really does need to be taken seriously as a warning sign of being capable and at risk of committing much worse crimes. In fact, I'm pointing at the finger mm-hmm. now. Recently on the YouTube channel, I covered the story of Libby Squire and Pavel Rolosevich, mm-hmm. Who was, this is a story that took place in England. Mm. And yeah, he was this guy who was going around his town, peeping Tom, mm. who was like jerking off in the corners and like looking in people's windows. And yeah, eventually yeah. then murdered this woman. But it was like this escalation.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, it's mad. Like, there's so many serial killers that seem to start off as this peeping Tom. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, it's a way to start experimenting with feeling of control and power. It's like, I'm looking at you and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
But even outside of school, Schaefer, he used to watch his young neighbor get undressed in her bedroom. And he would then tell people that she was purposely teasing him. Oh, which pissed him off. So,
yeah, this just, hooa! She's
like, psycho mentality.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. Just staring, like yeah. climbing a tree, staring in a window. She's tempting me. According to a former classmate at St. Thomas Aquinas High School, the girls at his school did their very best to keep away from him as he had a habit of looking up their skirts. Despite him having a reputation as a creep among his peers, Schaefer was actually considered a good student by his teachers, doing very well academically. He even excelled as an athlete, playing football and being a keen, and apparently very good, golfer, before he graduated in 1964 and went on to enroll at a community college in Broward County as a social studies major. He later abandoned social studies, though, in favor of pursuing a career in teaching. He only finished 2 years at a community college before applying for and receiving a scholarship from Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. During his further education, his grades were described as being very average compared to his excellent grades at school. But, you know, that's depending on when you believe his career as a killer began. It could be the very reason for him being distracted by his studies. Schaefer's teaching career didn't get off to a great start, as he was fired from his first internship position teaching geography for essentially being an arrogant prick. He apparently couldn't take criticism and often acted as though he was the sole authority on things he knew very little about. He wasn't out of work for long, though, scoring another position about 4 months later in March 1970, once again teaching geography, but this time at Stranahan High School. Again, it didn't last too long, as it quickly became obvious that he didn't actually know very much about the subject he was meant to be teaching, and was let go just weeks into the position. And Schaefer's dream of being a teacher was put on the back burner in favor of a new dream. Mm. Our Jerry was gonna be a cop. He actually had already been turned down from becoming a priest. Mm. So teacher, priest, cop, that's like the pedo trifecta.
He was turned down for being a priest for not having enough faith. Which, first, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
But secondly, how do you even test that?
Yeah.
And if it's simply just a straight out ask you question, how do you fail that?
Yeah, that's like, an interesting question. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Do you have enough faith? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, why do you want to be a priest then? Yeah. Like, why would he even want to be a priest then if he wasn't like a big...
Well, that's the thing. I was actually looking into it. I'd say it's because this guy, I feel he was just going down the list of best jobs to abuse your power.
That's a great point. That's why I said the pedo trifecta, because they tend to be, like, obviously they're very tough, hard jobs, but they do tend to
get a lot of authority.
A lot of people who, exactly.
I was actually reading a book before. It's called Murder in Plain Sight. It was written by a criminologist professor who gave the 12 occupations that are most favored by serial murderers, according to like patterns over the last 5 decades. Would you like to hear them?
I would.
Okay. So he actually divides the occupations into 4 separate categories, depending on the level of skill and qualification. So skilled occupations, there's aircraft machinist, shoemaker, repair person, and car upholsterer. Then you have semi-skilled occupations, which is forestry worker or arborist, truck driver, and warehouse manager. Mm-hmm. Unskilled occupations, general labour, hotel porter, gas station attendant, and then professional and government occupations, which is police and security official, military personnel, or religious official.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Some of them I would not have expected.
No, I was quite surprised by like the aircraft machinist and the shoemaker.
Yeah.
But there you are.
Well, there you go. In September 1970, aged 24, Gerard Schaefer applied for a vacancy with the Wilton Manors Police Department. Though for a hard right-winger, Jerry was rather liberal with the truth during his application, conveniently forgetting he'd recently been fired twice from teaching posts. Instead, he filled a time gap by falsely claiming to have been a research assistant at Florida Atlantic University. Luckily for Schaefer, no one actually bothered to verify his work history. It's not like he was applying for a role with significant authority over other people or anything like that. Ultimately, Schaefer became a patrolman with the Wilton Manors Police Department in September 1971. Things weren't rosy, though, for too long, as Schaefer was let go after 6 months in the post after it came to light that he had made it a habit to stop female motorists for little to no reason other than copy their details obtained during traffic stops, and then he would contact them outside of work and ask them to go on a date with him, which is incredibly inappropriate. And also, Jerry was very much married at the time. Somehow, despite his dismissal from Wilton Manors PD, Schaefer was quickly able to score himself a new position with the Martin County Sheriff's Office, working under Sheriff Robert Crowder. Crowder later told the press that Schaefer had no criminal record when applying for the post.
Apart from like all the creepy shit that he used to do, he was also just a really bad police officer. The police chief at the time later said that Schaefer used poor judgment and did dumb things. So, for example, when he was sent out on to control traffic after an accident, Schaefer, he just wandered off into the shop.
He was like, ah, oh, fuck this shit.
You know, he walked off to get some snacks in the local shop. And then, just real stupid, dumb shit.
Yeah, just a lazy bastard.
Yeah.
Jerry's personal life was filled with just as much turmoil as his work life. He first got married in December 1968 to a woman named Martha Marty Louise Fogg, who he had met during his time at Broward Community College and had fallen in love with when he'd seen her singing songs about how much she loved Merca and how much she didn't like hippies. I love her already. No wonder. Schaefer thought to himself, I don't like hippies either. We should get married. And they did. Like most marriages based on mutual dislikes of peace-loving people, it didn't go great. Apparently, Marty wasn't quite into the El Bonkin as Jerry was and got quite pissed off with his constant nagging for sexy times. The two separated and divorced after getting married in May 1970, with Marty saying that the reason was because Jerry was extremely cruel. Details don't go too much further than that, but the accusation is easy to believe with what he would go on to do, and by this stage, actually, probably had already been doing for quite some time.
Sounds like father, like son.
Mm-hmm. Schaefer met his second wife, 19-year-old Teresa Dean, who had been working as a secretary at the time, in January 1971, months before he'd applied to be a police officer. They got married less than 9 months later in September 71 in Fort Lauderdale, around 2 months after he joined the police. Jerry and Teresa generally got on much better as she was more willing to go along with what Jerry wanted and even joined him on his fishing trips to the Everglades. Somehow, Schaefer had gotten away with a lot of things that really should have got him put away a lot sooner than he was. Even when it came to finally being punished for kidnapping Nancy Trotter and Paula Wells in late 1972, Schaefer would barely get a slap on the wrist compared to what he could and should have been given. So, after he kidnapped them, tied them to a tree with a noose, and then they escaped, and then he said, oh, I was just trying to trick him. After pleading guilty to a single count of aggravated assault, Schaefer was given the batshit crazy sentence of 1 year in prison with the possibility of parole after 6 months followed by 3 years of probation. Yeah, for kidnapping and threatening to horrifically rape and murder two teenage girls, he was basically given a 6 month sentence. He wouldn't even go to prison, just the county jail as the sentence was so short. At his sentencing, the judge treated him like he'd ran over his neighbor's dog and not reported it, and not the terrifying crimes he'd actually committed. The judge, D.C. Smith, told him he was a, quote, foolish and astronomic jackass, and even allowed Schaefer to have his sentence postponed until after the holidays. Schaefer reported to Martin County Jail on January 15th, 1973, to begin serving his six-month sentence.
That's mad. It's like, yeah, jail doesn't really work for me right now.
Yeah.
Can we reschedule?
In March 1973, Jerry was about halfway through his sentence for aggravated assault when, who comes back to the story, but Lucille Place. She was sorting through some of her missing daughter, Susan's, things when she came across a letter signed Jerry Shepherd. Lucille had never seen the letter before and immediately thought it might lead to her daughter. And so she drove over to the sender's address at 333 Martin Avenue in Stuart, Florida. She spoke to the building manager about her situation and soon found he had no record of a Jerry Shepherd, but he did have a Gerard Schaefer who was renting a room from him at the time. Jerry had rented a room in his real name. This was the first concrete link between Gerard Schaefer and the missing girls, Suzanne Place and George Jessup. Lucille would later positively ID Schaefer as Shepherd from a staff photograph Wilton Manor's PD had of him.
The parents in this way, they were brilliant. And they did a lot of the work that the police should have been doing.
Yeah.
So both Susan's and George's parents, they were out driving most evenings searching for their daughters. And pretty sure, as far as the police were concerned at this point, the teenage girls were just the typical runaways. So they weren't like looking too hard. So
yeah,
it was really, the parents did a lot of work. I think without the parents, like, we wouldn't know today.
Yeah, absolutely. So it didn't get him arrested, but Lucille Place had given investigators more than enough to begin warming the cold case about what happened to her daughter and her daughter's friend, and they had plenty of reason to look into Gerard Schaefer, especially considering what he had just been convicted of, but barely did any time for. The case then went into overdrive when a father and son out collecting cans to recycle for some much-needed cash in Oak Hammock Park in Port St. Lucie, Florida, which was less than 6 miles away from where Trotter and Wells had made their narrow escape. This father and son came across the remains of two human beings scattered around a shallow hole that was partially obscured by dense tree line and foliage. One of the bodies, or what remained of it at least, was completely naked. The other had tatters of blue denim on the lower half. The jeans appeared to have a logo with a Roadrunner cartoon on it, making it very distinctive. The makeshift grave was only a couple of inches deep and about 200 feet from a dirt road. Had it not been clearly disturbed by scavenging animals, no one would have ever noticed it. An investigation of the scene revealed the grisly details behind the victims' deaths. Both these bodies found young females, likely teenagers, and had both been bound to trees and murdered at the scene, which already is sounding kind of familiar. Now, if you've ever seen the movie Wolf Creek or have read about the inspiration for that movie, Ivan Milat, or watched that chapter video I made on Ivan Milat a couple years ago, you'll probably, well, you've got a fair idea of what had happened. So the murderer here, and I mean, we can say Gerard at this stage, delighted in psychological torture. He was notorious for taking two girls at a time, and he would force his victims to decide which one would die first. Then he would sever both girls' spinal cords at the base, rendering them paralyzed. The victims each suffered several blows from a large, heavy knife, likely a machete, that had completely severed their limbs. Both bodies had been decapitated post-mortem, and both had extensive trauma to their jawbones, injuries probably inflicted by being repeatedly struck in the mouth while still alive. The victims were quickly identified as Susan Place and Georgia Jessup using dental records, and they both had gone through hell before being killed. Wounds sustained from being bound to the trees showed they had been kept there alive for several hours at least. Place had also suffered a gunshot wound from a .22 pistol to the face. Carved into the tree above the girls' heads was a very clear GJ. Which is probably some of the most arrogant fucking shit I've ever heard a serial killer do. Literally carving your Gerard John initials into the goddamn tree.
Yeah, it's like, it's all sick. It's all horrible. But that really irked me.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, he's like, I own you.
Yeah.
It's messed up.
Shockingly, the discovery spurred investigators to immediately obtain multiple search warrants for Schaefer's properties in both Broward County for his mother's home and Schaefer's own marital home in Martin County, and pushed Schaefer to quickly seek out legal representation. So to go into detail on every little piece of incriminating evidence found as a result of these search warrants would require me talking to you for about 3 days. But the too long didn't read of it is that after the warrant on Schaefer's mom's home, he was totally fucked, and they hadn't even searched his own home yet. So just a few tidbits of the mountain of what would end up in the prosecution's exhibits were tons of stories, quote-unquote, that Schaefer had written, depicting the extensive torture of young, captive women. Some of these stories featured the protagonist, usually a rogue cop, keeping the teeth of his victims. And yeah, you know where this is going. They did find human teeth and bone fragments among Schaefer's possessions. The teeth and fragments were confirmed to be from at least 8 different people. Polaroids found ranged from pictures of Schaefer binding himself to a tree in women's underwear for extra effect, all the way to what appeared to be a variety of butchered human bodies. Now, those Polaroids of the dead humans were later linked to a letter Schaefer had gotten in July 71. He had received images from an Australian man that Schaefer had met during his travels and were taken from a tribal massacre somewhere in a Saharan village. So, weren't bodies of people Schaefer killed, but he just liked looking at pictures of dead people. As you do. Hey, listen, he would have loved fucking... What was that website that used to be around?
Oh, God.
Rotten.com.
Yeah, Rotten.com, yeah. Yeah.
Is that still going?
I doubt it.
I'm sure it's been shut down a long time ago.
Speaking about the stories that you mentioned, there's a book called The Evil That Men Do, written by a FBI profiler who said something interesting about them.
Yeah.
So, just as an FYI, this is a bit graphic.
Okay.
So... In the stories, Schaefer wrote that he kidnapped hitchhikers whom he drove to remote, selected locations deep within the Florida swamps. There he would set up a stepladder underneath a tree limb and direct the girls and women at gunpoint to mount the ladder nude. Schaefer, he then placed a noose over the victim's neck, threw the rope over the tree limb, attached the other end to his car's bumper, put the vehicle in reverse and backed away slowly until the noose lifted a woman from the ladder and was hanged to death.
Jesus, that is... Horrific.
This isn't even the worst part, man. So he would then proceed to have sex with the dead body, then bury her nearby. He'd also repeatedly return to the scene, dig up the body, and have sex again. So, yeah, real sick shit here. But what's interesting is that Schaefer, he managed to legally protect these horrifying stories. See, it began with a visit to a psychiatrist, where he confided to the doctor that he was having these horrible fantasies of hanging women and having sex with them after. So, as Schaefer had hoped, the doctor decided that it would be therapeutic if he wrote down his fantasies, which he did, to great delight. The resultant documents, which were later discovered among his possessions, where he richly recounted Schaefer's deviant adventures, but they were covered under doctor-patient confidentiality. So they could never be used as legal evidence against him.
Who
so,
was his therapist? Fucking Ronald McDonald? Like, geez, I know, what a clown. Yeah.
It's like it was such a loophole. But
this story is true. Like you already said it, but this story is just like fuck up after fuck up after fuck up.
Yeah,
like, just getting away with this shit.
Yeah, yeah.
My God. So a major discovery was Schaefer's trophy box, which was a selection of items, including passports and jewelry that belonged to several teenage girls. Though they didn't find anything linking Place or Jessup in the box, they did find items linking Schaefer to a bunch of other disappearances. A gold locket with the name Lee inscribed on it that was identified belonging to a Lee Hainline Bonades, and she just so happened to be a neighbor of the then teenage Jerry Schaefer. Her body was actually found in Boca del Mar 9 years after she went missing in 1978, but she wasn't formally identified until 2004.
I can't believe he kept all this in his mother's house.
Yeah, I know. In January 1973, two 19-year-old hitchhikers, Colette Marie Goodenough and Barbara Ann Wilcox, disappeared while on a hike in Sioux City, Iowa, to Florida, and they were last seen alive in Biloxi, Mississippi. Wilcox's driver's license and Goodenough's passport were both among the items found in Schaefer's treasure box. The skeletal remains of both girls were later discovered close to a large tree in January 1977, having been bound to the tree with baling wire. A crate found nearby the remains was thought to have been used by Schaefer to stand on it while torturing and killing them. This was during the time that Schaefer was out on bail awaiting sentencing for his little prank on Wells and Trotter. And just like Place and Jessup, had he been locked up where he should have been, they could have been alive.
I know that after he was released on bail, Schaefer's family, they said that he'd act quite normal, as though nothing had happened and he didn't have any worries at all. Now, you were mentioning earlier on. However, the way in which he escalated his crimes during this time period, it kind of just suggests that he knew that his time was limited.
He's like trying to get as many people as possible.
That was it. Yeah, yeah. He's like, I've like very limited time here. I'm going to go out and just cause absolute carnage.
Yeah.
Also, I just wanted to know like something regarding his trophy box that you mentioned. So initially, after they gathered all the jewelry, purses, IDs, passports, driving licenses, all that stuff, they came up with a number of 28 people missing or presumed dead. they didn't have like any hard evidence to this, but it was just the initial number that they come up with. However, after investigators started looking into each of these possible victims, they found that a couple of people from that list were actually still alive.
Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah. So it turns out that Schaefer, the prick he was, will sometimes just take people's IDs when you pull them over, just to be an asshole.
Yeah.
And just, you know, to give them a hard time. But they do reckon that the number of people murdered by Schaefer was between 14 and 16 from what they found in the box.
Yeah. So, the day after the search of his mother's property had turned up so much, a warrant was executed at Schaefer's home in Martin County. And while it didn't provide anywhere near the same level of explosive evidence that the Broward County warrant did, investigators still found several knives and a pistol stashed in a shed on the property. The biggest discovery was actually in his wife's possession, though. See, sometime around November, a year earlier, Schaefer had gifted his wife a suede purse. Georgia Jessup's suede purse, one of his victims. When police discovered this, his wife recalled that Schaefer had called her earlier and told her to get rid of the purse around the beginning of April, the same time the bodies were discovered in Oak Hammock Park. Can you imagine what his wife thought? It's like, this is a, my husband killed this teenage girl and he gave me her shit.
I know.
That's like,
yeah,
that's sick. Messed up.
And she didn't listen, throw it away.
Idiot. Yeah. After a couple of months of back and forth between prosecutors and Schaefer's defense team, in which they argued over whether or not he was mentally fit to stand trial, Schaefer was finally declared fit to face charges for the murders of Place and Jessup, Susan Place and George Jessup, albeit with a huge addendum that he was suffering from paranoid psychosis and was acutely sexually deviant. Schaefer's trial for the murders of Place and Jessup began on September 17, 1973. Ultimately, they would be the only crimes he would be tried for, which is a crime in and of itself. Schaefer faced life in prison as the death penalty had been declared unconstitutional in the state by the Supreme Court, and so sadly the chair wasn't an option for old Jerry. Schaefer, being the complete and utter narcissist he was, obviously pleaded not guilty despite the mountain of evidence against him. It took just over 5 hours of deliberations for the jury to return a unanimous verdict of guilty in both Place's and Jessup's murders. Even after his guilt became official, Jerry Schaefer still remained resolute and told reporters in the courtroom, "That's the roll of the dice. I had a good defense. I'm innocent." I don't know if he sounded like that, but
yeah,
why not?
We'll go with it. Yeah.
Why not? Maybe that's the roll of the dice.
So he, that's it.
That's it.
That's gotta be it.
I had a good defense. I'm innocent. That's how he said it. Yeah. Schaefer's last hope to avoid prison saw his legal team argue for him being involuntarily institutionalized rather than sending him to serve the rest of his life in Florida State Prison. Even after the rather weak attempt failed and Schaefer was sentenced to 2 concurrent life sentences, that didn't stop Schaefer from trying to have his sentence lightened, using his final comments to the court to request that he be sent to a psychiatric hospital rather than prison, despite still claiming to be completely innocent and now wrongfully convicted. He also later launched a spurious and ultimately unsuccessful appeal. Just to add a little extra spice on how much of a shithead he was, Schaefer also spent his time insisting that he'd been framed by prosecutors, and though he denied ever meeting Jessup or Place, he continuously disparaged their characters, wrongly calling them promiscuous heroin addicts, hoo-was, and police informants. All of his claims were complete bollocks, but that didn't matter to Schaefer. He's just one of the people who really does believe his own version of history.
Such an asshole.
Yeah.
They just need to lock him up and throw away the key and just like ignore him to stop listening. Another thing he tried to do to prove his innocence was his public defender actually married Schaefer's wife, Teresa Dean, a month after the trial.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
which is wild.
That is weird, yeah.
But Schaefer, he claimed that he didn't get the best defense because his lawyer wanted him behind bars to get out of his wife.
So he can get it. Yeah. It's good. Hey, listen, that's good.
He tried everything. But Schaefer, he filed a total of 19 appeals, all of which were dismissed.
Yeah.
In 1987, the judge, just like tired of the ongoing litigation, he declared that the judgment was final and Schaefer should realize that there was no hope for a release.
I mean, that probably should have been declared a lot earlier. Like, he shouldn't have gotten to digit number of appeals, but.
Yeah, that was absolutely ridiculous, yeah.
Yeah. So, during his time in prison, Schaefer also continued his little hobby of writing. Writing really messed up stories. Now, he called these supposedly fictional tales, quote, killer fiction, unquote. They often went into lurid detail describing acts of explicit violence and necrophilia. Not sure who his target audience was, just himself. And these definitely fictional stories often featured the crimes in question being committed by an active duty police officer. Some very cynical people think that the stories were actually just very lazily disguised descriptions of Schaefer's actual crimes, but I don't think that's true at all. Just like his psychiatrist, he was, you know, getting fantasies out of his head. Definitely not what he actually did to the, was it probably up to 18 people he killed, women he killed?
Yeah, like nobody, like.
Nobody will ever.
Yeah, because he's like such a bullshitter, always contradict himself. He's, yeah. Sometimes he's just like, I didn't kill anyone. Then he like released a book saying like, you know, how it would do it.
Now. Yeah, exactly.
And then other times
OJ
he would.
OJ style,
yeah.
I didn't do it, but this is how,
this
I
would, how
do
it
would
have done it.
Yeah.
And then there was other times when he like just told people he killed like up to 80 people, but that was like. Sometimes it's kind of like he was the same just for shock value. He just really enjoyed shocking people. So I know, I don't think we'll ever like know from him like what the truth was. So
right.
Yeah, just a fuckhead.
Schaefer also wins the award for most litigious convicted killer as he made it almost a full-time job to sue people from behind bars. His favorite targets included true crime writers who he felt disparaged him in their work. Schaefer, you're a fucking dickhead.
No, Michael, sue.
Oh, God. No, no. I can't afford to be sued. He even sued an ex-FBI agent named Robert Ressler, who had the audacity to describe Schaefer as a serial killer, which doesn't have to be three or more in separate instances, and he only was ever convicted of two.
Technically.
Excuse me. Technically, I'm not sure. Yeah. His list of legal battles also included a suit against an ex-girlfriend, Sandra London, who also served as a co-author to Schaefer, helping him write his, quote, killer fiction, unquote. Schaefer would just not go away quietly. See, London and Schaefer parted ways in 1991, and London went on to publicly denounce Schaefer. Wow, what a brave move, denouncing his fucking monster serial killer. Schaefer had a totally normal reaction to such a situation by threatening to kill her.
Yeah.
London was easily able to have the lawsuit thrown out by presenting the court with more than 500 pages of Schaefer's writing and letters. See, in his letters to Sandra London, Schaefer told her that he had actually started killing women way back in 1965 when he was only 19 years old. Not only did he brag about how he'd taken Jessup and Place in gross detail, on another occasion, Schaefer claimed he was responsible for the disappearance of schoolgirls 9-year-old Peggy Rann and 8-year-old Wendy Stevenson in December 1969. He told London he had killed and eaten the young girls after taking them from Pompano Beach. Naturally, Schaefer flat out denied this publicly, claiming London had made the entire thing up. Another Jewel disappearance linked to Jared was from October 1966. See, on October 2nd, 20-year-old Pamela Nader and 21-year-old Nancy Luckner were in Alexander Springs, a recreation park area in Florida. They were there with their boyfriends, and between 2 and 3 p.m., the two lads decided to go for a walk around this park, leaving Nancy and Pamela at some picnic tables. When the boyfriends got back, they were not there, and they were never seen again. They searched and searched and searched. They called the cops. The entire park was searched, but no dice. Years later, a witness would say he saw Jared Schaefer idling near the girls, and when they went for a walk, he followed them. And an inmate would say he confessed to it. Jared Schaefer, he sometimes wrote to the police asking about different crimes and whether he was being investigated for them. One of the letters, he asked the cops if he was being investigated for this unsolved mystery in Alexander Springs. So, the ex-cop was obviously not a popular guy in prison, but actually went some way to ingratiate himself with his fellow convicts by acting as sort of a jailhouse lawyer, offering to help others with their cases by doing things like writing appeal letters, which he was a fucking expert at, as he just mentioned. Unfortunately, though, for those foolish enough to trust him, Schaefer would go right to the authorities with information inmates had confided in him and traded the info for better conditions for himself. He's like the ultimate pathetic rat shithead. Evidence he passed on helped to get one guy sent to death row, and in 1983, when he was briefly transferred to Avon Park Correctional Institution, Schaefer helped authorities to gather evidence against Mervyn Eric Cross. Mervyn Cross was another total piece of shit who had actually managed to continue running a child pornography ring from behind bars. Schaefer was even able to give them the two names of Cross's accomplices. One of them turned out to be a school teacher. Despite the evidence Schaefer gave, in helping put these scumbags behind bars, and in Cross's case, solitary confinement, it's worth remembering that Schaefer didn't do any of this out of trying to help people or thinking it's the right thing to do. He just thought it would help himself put himself in a better situation, because Schaefer was also partial to children. Now, Schaefer might not have faced the old mortal needle drop at the hands of the state, but that didn't mean he'd be dying peacefully in his sleep either. As, I guess maybe being a piece of shit and rat in jail came back to haunt him. He was unceremoniously stabbed to death on December 3rd, 2005, at the maximum security Florida State Prison by a fellow prisoner named Vincent Rivera. Now, it's sort of unknown why he killed Jared. Maybe it was because Jared was just ratting on people. But it also seems like Vincent Rivera was a hell of a psycho. He had real, real problems. Some people said about Vincent Rivera, he was the most ghoulish person they ever met, that kind of thing. Just a born killer.
Yeah, there's a lot of crazy people in jail, isn't
there? Amazingly, Keith, yeah, you're on the shock. He was discovered already long expired on the floor of his cell, having been stabbed more than 40 times in the head and the face, which left his right eye pretty much non-existent. Couldn't have happened to a nicer fellow.
Mm-hmm.
He also sustained deep wounds to the neck and torso, including having his throat slit for good measure. A grotesquely violent death for a man that prosecutor Robert Stone called the most sexually deviant person he'd ever had the misfortune to have met. I'd say good riddance, but knowing what we do about Schaefer's predilections, it was probably exactly how he wanted to go.
So happy.
Yeah, that's a pretty good ending.
I feel like I should clap, but well, I guess we don't have to worry about being sued by him.
So yeah, exactly.
That's, cool. That's a load off my mind.
For a second, just might get back to Schaefer.
it's crazy how when he went after him for two murders, though.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose there was never just enough there to put him away for all the other shit he's been linked to. I mean, as you said, it's like, 18? He's been linked to 18 murders and disappearances. God only knows how many he was actually involved in. But a lot of these ones, the links are kind of like tenuous at best. Yeah. Plus, I mean, he was put away for life for those two. So it's like, what else are you going to do?
Like, even just looking at the time he was out on bail, there were six women in total that went missing during that 6-month period.
Wow.
Which were later found dead with evidence of torture. There was Susan Place and Georgia Jessup, who went missing in September, which he did go to prison for. But there was also Colette Goodenough and Barbara Wilcox. They went missing in January 1973. So it was like a week before Schaefer was sent to jail. And both of those women's IDs were found in Schaefer's trophy box. There was also 14-year-old Mary Briscolina and 13-year-old Elisa Farmer. They went missing from around the same location as your other women, and their bodies were found a little later, but were also tortured in similar fashion. But as you said, like, apparently they just didn't have enough sufficient evidence to secure convictions on the case.
Yeah.
Like, there was a lot of suspicions, but it was like circumstantial evidence, which I don't know how, especially like those two women were, like, they were found in the same, with the same MO, and their IDs were found.
Yeah, when their IDs were found, it's like,
I don't get how they didn't, like, I don't know. I just feel like there needs to be better closure for the families, but
that's true. But I mean, throughout this entire story is like police kind of being inept again and again. Yeah. Like, that's how he was able to get away with this for so long. So they probably would have just made it worse if they actually probably. Maybe they did try and link
maybe
it to him. There was like, oh, they wrote down the wrong license plate again. Some shit like that. Yeah. But there you go, Shinee.
Yeah.
That is the story of Jerry Schaefer.
Messed up, man. Messed up.
Very, very, very dark one. Final thoughts, Keith,
I don't know. Just do the opposite of what Schaefer would do.
Couldn't have said it better myself. You took the words right out of my mouth. All right. Hope you enjoyed this whole episode of the TC Potty. It means a lot. This actually ended up being a little bit of a longer episode than usual, which is kind of cool. So there you go. All right. That wraps it up.
Yeah.
Cool. Talk to you next week.
Sometimes things just end.
Yeah, it just kind of sort of ends. All right, here. Thanks so much for listening. Means a lot to me. Means a lot to Keith. And here, listen. Every episode out on Monday. That's it. It's Monday.
Monday.
All right. A new episode out every Monday. So give it a view wherever you get your podcasts. And sort of ends. All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. I'll see you.
There you go. I was waiting for that. I can't end the episode until I get this. All right. Thanks, guys. Bye. Don't be too harsh on him.
He's doing his best, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's a hardworking man.
Blue collar.
Yeah. Just do what he can for his wife and kids. The ungrateful wife and those rugrats. Throughout his young life and into his teens, Jerry Schaefer was always a bit of a... Keith's just shaking his head here. Sometimes you look so uncomfortable doing this podcast.
It's a weird hill to die on.
Okay. Hey, I have my phone.